Hello and welcome to the final podcast of the season. We're going to take a step back for June and July, but we'll be back in August for Ireland's four Rugby World Cup warm-up games, and then we'll give it the full heave as part of RTE's extensive World Cup coverage. So what do we have for you today? Well, we're going to chat to Stephen Ferris about the Back Row Blues in a moment. We've an exclusive interview with Jacob Stockdale, and we'll kind of drift in and out of grading the province's report card after another eventful domestic season came to a close, with Leinster lifting the Pro 14 trophy to make sure that there was a trophy coming back to Ireland, as we're used to now, spoilt and all as we are. With me in studio are, against the head producer, Wes Liddy, and Michael Glennon of RTE Online. And the headlines are going to be read for you now by Michael.
Two big news stories from yesterday was the Ireland training squad announcement for the World Cup, mostly along expected lines, and two ones that were probably unusual. Mike Haley and John Klein from Munster included, probably a surprise to some people. Yesterday morning, Rob Kearney confirmed he was signing on for another 9 months with the IRFU. I think he wanted a longer extension, but that's what they were prepared to give him. Sean O'Brien.
That's a bit yellow pack for one of Ireland's greatest servants, isn't it? 9 months.
Yeah, what? I mean, I probably.
Will you get a text message telling him he's playing on the morning now or not, or your services are not needed? Yeah. I'd be slightly flippant, but the 9 month thing probably is why, because he's going to the World Cup.
Yeah, so he would have been contracted up to the World Cup.
Anyway.
Anyway, okay. So this was to take him to the end of the next season. Sean O'Brien ruled out, so the news came out that he's going to undergo a hip surgery, and that just keeps him well out until into the new year, they think.
Yeah, I mean, that's a shocker. I mean, that would have a podcast all on its own, the Sean O'Brien saga.
Yeah, very disappointing for him. Big loss.
Big bad week.
Not a great finish to his Ireland career.
No, it's a shame. And we'll talk to Fez about him in a minute too.
We also, World Rugby have put out a new high tackles clampdown, and they've a video on that. We're just going to listen to a clip from that now.
For the high tackle, the first question is which part of the tackler makes contact with the head of the ball carrier. In this case, it's the tackler's arm. The next question is whether the head contact is direct or indirect. Here, we clearly see the contact from the arm to the head is direct. The officials next evaluate the degree of danger. Here, the danger level is high because the tackler's arm is moving forward prior to the contact, and the tackler completes the tackle. As a result of the direct arm to the head with high danger, the initial decision would be a red card.
So that lady took a break from doing the GPS voicing in Australia, didn't she? Very clear. That's really hard to talk about, isn't it?
Yeah, so we just recommend that people go on.
It's a very visual thing. Like.
Yeah, so if you go on to the World Rugby website or YouTube, or if you see on the RT Rugby Twitter account, we've tweeted that video. So it's part of the clampdown for player safety and anti-concussion measures. And it seems to be trying to make it clearer for the referee to know which route to go down, whether it's a shoulder charge or a high tackle, and from what options are with the officials. So it's actually really worth looking at, so that people and commentators can inform themselves of why a referee has given a decision. And it's part of a culture change in rugby. So it's something that they hope becomes natural. People don't react crazy to some decisions if they can't understand them. So it's really worth looking at.
Discretion is a dirty word in modern life. I mean, there should be no such thing. Just because you know a fella is a good guy, you don't leave him off if he throws a bit of newspaper wrapping on the pavement. You give him the full fine and all the rest of it. There's, you know, this whistleblower culture has another end as well, that there's no such thing as discretion in human business. Is there any discretion built into this? I know intent isn't a defence, but
yeah, it's
quite plain sometimes that fellas don't go in to take the head off someone and it happens accidentally.
Yeah, well, what they have here is aggravating and mitigating factors. So for one of the aggravating factors would be if you had a clear line of sight to the guy you were about to tackle. So you have no real excuse then. It's another thing if a guy comes out of nowhere, or if you're being blindsided or something like that. So they're supposed to take that into account as well.
Okay. Yeah. And as you said, you'd guide people to the RTE Online, RTE Sport Twitter account, because yeah, that'll give you the links to the actual videos.
Exactly, exactly.
Rob Kearney's one the weekend was interesting.
It was yellow. I think it was good, really? Right decision.
I thought it was, by the letter of the law, it was banker red.
Yeah, I mean, in this day and age.
He jumped after the other guy jumped. There was no hands wrapped. It was like, there's no doubt it was dangerous play.
What do you do when you're running at full tilt towards a high ball?
Where's your eye line? Jump into the man who's already in the air would be a good start.
But sure, he didn't even look at the man, which I'm not saying.
But he should have, because the point is that it's Rob Kearney, yeah. And he is very aware for being a brilliant fullback.
Like, obviously, he wasn't trying to take anyone out.
Sure,
but
we know that.
But
yeah.
It was massively clumsy, like.
Yeah,
shockingly out of the player.
You know,
say,
I always think that the punishment fits the crime because it was a bad one on Hogg, but it wasn't a kind of a. He didn't come down on his.
It ended his game. Hogg didn't come back after.
When they're chasing a try, and you know, like the psychological blow of a red card to a team is bigger as well. So I mean, that's a very big call, you know.
Yeah, I agree, but like, there's something about the aerial combat again, and I know even the kind of. The warfare analogies now are rightly getting slagged, as we use so many of them in rugby. But there is something about two fellas going for a high ball that is a fantastic part of the combat side of rugby.
Yeah, it's very rare you see it, though, two fellas genuinely contesting.
I don't think so. I mean, you often see four hands on the ball and one party comes away with it.
I mean, the amount of time that both people are legitimately entitled to jump is very rare, because if someone has got off the ground before the other, really, to be squeaky clean, you have to just leave him take it.
Yeah, the onus is now on the guy who's second, and you should be able to make a judgment call if you... Obviously, if you're going up to genuinely contest the ball, that's one thing. But if you're going up into the mix to see what happens...
The ball was in Hogg's hands before Rob Kearney even got off the ground. Like, he'd no business contesting that ball.
If he'd been watching Hogg, he'd have seen it. But because he wasn't watching, it's more or less...
Well, if he's watching the ball, he sees it landing in his arms.
Yeah, in that split second. I don't know. I mean, I'm not defending Rob Kearney. I think a yellow card was fair, as I said, but... It's a bit back.
And in fairness to him, he handled it unbelievably well in terms of going over.
He did.
Apologising both on the field and after, you know, so.
And Hogg accepted the apology, which says a lot as well.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, look, yeah, the spirit of the game, it's probably a yellow. The strictest interpretation of the law, it's a red.
You see, it's this split second decision making that's also when it comes to things like spear tackling, you know, that you have to feather bed the player down again. I mean, I always struggle with how. The human animal can go full tilt into combat and contact, take a fella out, which he's legitimately entitled to do, and the split second after he's put him out of the game, thereby advantaging his own team and doing his job, he has to become a Florence Nightingale.
Yeah, but that's predicating that he had to tilt him over beyond the horizontal, which he didn't. He can hit him as hard as he wants, he just doesn't have to lift him up off the ground.
But like, that's physics taking over. No,
not really with a spear situation, to be fair.
Well, like, the drive, I agree, when does a horizontal become gravity-based and when does it become...
A guy will lift sometimes, but you don't have to tilt him to a point where his shoulder or head is arrowing at the ground. I mean, OK, the odd time it will happen, but I think it happens a lot now at clear-out situations as much, you know, and it's probably more of a danger there than tackling in a lot of ways. Mm.
But you also see that's happening less and less now. And when it does happen, there's a bigger reaction off the players and the crowd straight away that they know.
That's how culture has changed, Michael, isn't it?
That's exactly it.
It's like in soccer where a certain, you know, someone dives and the crowd gets irate. It's almost like people are conditioned to overreact to a certain incident now, you know.
So, Stephen Ferris, what is now beyond the pale when it comes to... remember eye gouging and hitting a fella in the testicles used to be kind of frowned at, even within the game. I mean, there's still a large element of self-policing within rugby. I mean, there has to be.
Yeah, for sure. I think Darren, I'm going to have to agree with the two lads, and I think it's going to be 3-1. That should have definitely been a red card at the weekend. I think all this here started... If you can remember back in 2012 in the European Cup game in Belfast, where, you know, Jared Payne ran into Good and he ended up landing badly on his neck, and that was the kind of start of it all. You know, Jared Payne didn't get off the ground. There was no safety involved, and he took the guy out, and it was exactly the same at the weekend. You say Hogg didn't land on his head. He didn't land on his head, but he landed on his shoulder and his head whacked off the ground. Now, for me, that's a red card. Would it have had an outcome on the game? I probably not, but I got to agree with the lads. Psychologically, when you get somebody sent off, it can really give you a boost. But for me, yeah, it was definitely a red card at the weekend, but... You know, I think the game of rugby, you could argue every tackle situation, every ruck encounter, Every carry, you have something to say about it. You're sitting in the Aviva Stadium and every single punter beside you is shouting for a penalty here and a penalty there and a high tackle here and a high tackle there, you know. So I think everybody has their own interpretation of the rules, and it's a very difficult job the referee has every single game. But, you know, when these big calls are needed, they got to get them right. Nigel Owen's got it wrong.
OK, and listen, well put. I mean, I'm looking at these new high tackle frameworks and I'm kind of exporting a little bit of the language there. But degree of danger seems to be a big thing now. And the way you put it there, the degree of danger to Hogg was, you know, was 9 out of 10.
Yeah, okay. It wasn't. Yeah, a degree of danger, you know, when you're tackling somebody, you don't have it in the back of your head. Okay, what's the degree of danger going to be here if I absolutely try and smash him in the next week?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't have that mindset going into a rugby match, thinking, you know, how you're going to enter into rocks and the degree of danger here and there. And I think it's probably more done on the training pitch, that you kind of learn the better techniques and the safer techniques. And we all know that the tackle height is trying to be lowered, and guys are trying to wrap around the ankles a lot more. It's just an ongoing thing within professional rugby that's going to have to continue to be looked at and try and make the game safer. It's easier said than done when the guys are getting bigger and stronger and faster and fitter. And, you know, I think that's more the concern inside of it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think within a decade, there'll be plausible calls for rugby to be outlawed.
It's lucky degree of danger wasn't involved when Fez was playing, or every time he tried to tackle someone, he'd have been blown up for degree of danger to the opponent.
No, he can't get done for intent. But no, jokes aside, there will be. I mean, there's a backlash, or not a backlash, whatever it is, there's a cultural shift. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I said it jokingly to them that maybe schoolboy rugby should be outlawed, and they were saying, yeah, there's a case for that, you know. And this was a well-meaning person. This wasn't like so-called snowflake. This was somebody who had read something about one particular poor kid who got, luckily, not life-changing damage done, but significant concussion. And they were saying, how can we still allow that? You know? Yeah, I mean, it's an elephant in the room. At some stage, public culture will turn towards, we don't want this stuff. This is barbaric, and we'll have to take out a lot of the physical danger out of the sport. Call me a dinosaur, but I like the edge of danger in physical sport, and that's why I'm a spectator.
Yeah, well, if you're asking me, it was probably something that brought me a lot of friends, brought me a lot of discipline to myself, and, you know, learning values along the way. And, you know, it just wasn't all about going out and playing team rugby. You learn a lot of ethics, and even the training that went in, I made myself fitter. You know, if you're going to make yourself fitter, of course, it's going to make you healthier. And for young kids to get out and be healthier, I think is very, very important. You know, I couldn't think of anything worse than sitting when I was 7 or 8 years of age just playing Xbox or PlayStation 24/7. I was out enjoying myself, playing football, playing rugby, playing touch, playing tag or whatever. And I think, you know, that's got to change. You talk about physical contact sports that, you know, maybe be barbaric. NFL in America, you know, boxing, which is huge here in Ireland, and it's a tremendous sport. I think anything that can keep you active and you know, everybody talks about mental health as well these days. I think rugby is one of those sports that helps with that. And, you know, I really think that anybody who's criticising rugby going forward, he needs to actually give it a go, because it's for me, it's one of the best team sports in the world.
I think, Wes, too, there's an undertow of snobbishness, because a lot of people who are vocal in the debate wouldn't have any connection with boxing, so they're just totally unaware of boxing. They see rugby, they know rugby is, I hate saying it, but whatever, an ABC1 more middle-class sport, and they go, oh my God, we can't have that.
Yeah, it's probably back in the news a bit after that prime time about concussion last week. But
that's where it came from in my head too. Sorry.
There's also, like, obviously there's a few horrific injuries, particularly in France in the last few years, to underage players. But, I mean, because you see a professional international player being concussed in contact, that's really very little correlation to underage rugby, because the force is entirely different, and force is a determining factor in the seriousness of injury. So just because when two behemoths hit into each other, there's a shudder, doesn't mean that, you know, Mikey and Johnny in Willow Park at 7 years of age are doing significant damage to each other all the time. So it is a little overreacted. Look, boxing would be illegal if it was starting now from scratch. I don't agree with it. I love boxing, but, you know, the whole Queensbury rules is a way around the legal system of the time. So,
well, it's also kind of an acceptance that there is an some sort of urge or capability of violence in human beings, and it's better to harness it.
Well, to my understanding, if you go to the legal, if you go to the legal sanction, there's a thing that's like the judiciary don't like interfering in sporting bodies for a whole host of reasons. So anytime you take the field in a contact sport, there's a thing called implied sporting consent. So you acquiesce to a certain amount of damage that can be done to you by participating. But the point is, if you really get technical about it, you can't acquiesce to actual bodily harm or higher. So when they talk about intent versus outcome, the outcome is actually important. Like, if you hit me in the jaw with a punch in a match and I wasn't injured versus my jaw being broken, that it's not about the intent. It is actually about the seriousness of the outcome. So I guess there's a tipping point where a bunch of people sustain enough injuries that they go, no, hold on a minute, I'm not accepting that as a risk anymore, and I'm retrospectively deciding to challenge it legally. And then you get four, five, six of these cases. Then that's when the serious pressure starts to come on for significant rule change and things like that.
But, I mean, implied consent is an interesting one, because, Michael, I mean, Stephen, I'll ask first, do humans have the right to put themselves in danger if they're doing it of their own free will?
Yeah, good question. I think any time you take a rugby pitch, you know exactly what you're getting yourself into. You know the dangers, you know the consequences of injury. Of course, every time you run out, you don't want to get injured, but every rugby player, especially, as Wes says, in the professional game, knows there's a chance of getting injured. Would it stop me? If I could turn back the clock, Dara, and about the injuries that I had, I would have played the game exactly the same way. I loved it. I loved the physicality of it. And, you know, yes, I think small rule changes along the way will help the game and help it become safer. But, you know, running out onto a rugby pitch, every rugby player knows the consequences and the dangers of the game.
It has to be common sense. I mean, the rules by and large, or the laws, whatever you want to call them, were put in place when the physical capabilities of the players were far less than they are now. So there is an attempt to catch up with the increasing ability of the human to be a wrecking ball.
That's all you can ask, really.
That's all you can ask. I'd go along with that. Michael?
Yeah, well, I mean, they have to be seen to act, because it's getting a lot more attention. So if what happens in France and what happens in football fields all around, World Rugby have to be, they're talking to the parents saying, look, this is what we are doing, so you can still send your children to play.
Look at the GA the weekend. Paul Mannion for Dublin sent off. Like, he got himself into a really solid position. The contact was shoulder to shoulder. On the TV pictures, it was complicated by the ball hitting the Louds player in the face just as Mannion's shoulder collided. So his head rocked back on contact, but it may have been from the ball. And then his head hit the ground when he fell. So Mannion got the red card, and it looked shocking straight away, but when you actually looked at it slowly...
Take the ball out of it.
Well, also, it was just one guy who's basically a professional with the Dubs against a guy who's not. And at least in professional rugby, largely, you have fair contests where guys are prepared equally.
OK. Yeah, which brings us to the fact that we don't have all of the professionals that we want in this training squad, Stephen. And famously, you and... Jamie Heaslip and Sean O'Brien only played together 7 times despite having well over 100 caps between you, and that was down to injury. And the back row is an attritional part, and ever more so with the importance of the breakdown game, or with the importance of the breakdown in the modern game. So we're missing, we really are going to miss Levy, obviously. We're going to miss Sean O'Brien now, and we're getting close to... not crisis, but we can't really afford to lose Van der Fleer now, can we?
No, definitely not. And just touching on, you know, Levy there, you look at David Pocock, who's come out in the press this week. He's more or less given up on the Super Rugby. to try and get himself fit for the World Cup. That's probably his last hurrah. Mm. He's been out injured for, you know, so long over his career. I think the back row is such a traditional you know, position, and you know, the amount of contacts, if you go across all the stats, you know, it's the top tacklers, the top carriers, the top ruck involvements, it's always the back row. So no wonder those guys suffer a bit. But just to touch on Sean O'Brien, like, I think it's a huge loss, and the reason I think it's a huge loss is because, you know, if Josh Van der Freer gets injured, who there is going to play seven? You know, you look at that Munster team when they tried to put CJ Stander in at seven in their last game, that didn't work at all. And the only one that stands out for me within the training squad would probably be Jordy Murphy. And, you know, Jordy Murphy can play right across the board. But is he a Sean O'Brien? Is he a Josh Van der Freer at seven? I don't think he is. And it's funny, Dar, because if you were picking, if Ireland were playing next week in the World Cup against Scotland, mm-hmm. who would you be putting in the back row? And for me, it would be Josh Van der Freer. It
CJ.
Would be Reece Ruddock, and it would be Jack Conan.
Well, Jack Conan had an unbelievable end to the season, I agree. So you'd have no Stander or O'Mahony just because of the balance.
I just think, yeah, you know, we all know Peter O'Mahony has been superb over the last couple of years. He's just lacking a bit of form. I think he's mm-hmm. slightly off the pace in the last number of games of the season. And if you're going on form, as it is at the minute, look, a lot can change in these four warm-up games. But I have to agree with your question there. If George Van der Fleer gets injured, and we all know he's susceptible to injuries as well, I think, you know, there could be a little bit of a crisis at seven because there isn't that much experience of other guys that are playing at the top level with a seven on their back. So, you know, there's a lot of talent there, but we definitely can't afford to lose too many more bodies.
And, you know, is this connected with the kind of power thing that's really knocking around the back of my brain? And forgive me here, but I suppose on a podcast I can take a little bit more time to ask a question, because if you and me, Stephen, and Wes and Michael, we'll all be working here on the World Cup, and fantastic, we're looking forward to it, but we'll be positioning it for our viewers and our listeners. And as of now, if it was starting tonight and Ireland were playing in a week's time, I'd be saying, if you look at what our problems have been, we've been overpowered in the Six Nations twice. Munster have been overpowered when it mattered. Leinster have been overpowered only once, but in the biggest game of the season. Then Leinster went in on Saturday and really outplayed Glasgow, who are a fantastic team to watch, I have to say. But Leinster outplayed and were superior to Glasgow. They were 8 points up. They went around the corner for about 7 or 8 minutes, hit after hit after recycle after hit, didn't come away with the match-killing score, looked completely played out. Glasgow get a try, they're within three, and Leinster are hanging on then, and the clock bails them out because they are so empty after the effort. Again, that boils back down to, you know, number one, we just don't have the natural monsters. And number two, our guys are being forced to write checks their bodies can cash.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that fair?
It's fair, and you can't disagree with anything that you're saying. And when we come up against South Africa and when we come up against New Zealand, they do have the physical beast that we probably don't have, you know. And, you know, somebody like Peter O'Mahony, we all know how much of a warrior he is, how much of a leader he is, how good he is in the line-out. But he doesn't carry much ball, you know. And, you know, if you were going around the room and you were pointing to people about who's going to carry and who's going to run through brick walls for you, Peter O'Mahony's probably not one of those guys. George Van der Fleer is probably not one of those guys. And, you know, you really need your back row guys to stand up when the chips are down, when your back is against the wall, to give you that small bit of go forward. And that's when you probably touched on CJ Stander. He is that guy that can do that for you. But
he's out of form as well.
Form,
Yeah,
on form, it's just maybe that shimmying about in the back row hasn't helped things. However, you know, the back row is so, so important. And I've said it 100 times, and Paul O'Connell said it in the changing room before we left the run out onto the pitch. If you win the breakdown, you generally win the match. And, you know, who wins the breakdown? It's generally the back row players.
And it's generally the more powerful, given the fact that we're talking about elite athletes, you know? And where's this power is now a non-negotiable. Where are we going to get ours from? Not that we're not, well, you know, we're powerful, but it's relative, this discussion, relative to South Africa, relative to England, relative to,
yeah,
arguably, I guess, New Zealand, even though it's probably one of the areas where they're least ahead of us.
Yeah, well, I still think we have enough power. I still think there's guys there. You put Ian Henderson in there, into the second row,
yes.
You know, and Ryan in there as well, who's a 21-year-old beast who seems to have that, you know, superhuman strength that oozes week in, week out, and he seems to back it up all the time. So, you know, when you throw those two guys into the second row, you have Kane Healy, who seems to be getting some bit of the form back that he showed in 2011 at the World Cup. You have Furlong
just
there
a
as
bit.
Well. So, you know, I think there's plenty there, but, you know, those guys are going to be locked down in scrums for periods of time. They're going to be defending balls for periods of time. So the back row need to stand up and be counted. And, you know, it probably all goes back to what we initially chatted about there. Ireland can't really afford to lose too many more bodies.
Stephen, is there a case, because we see how important Devin Toner is to Ireland's second row. So is there a case then for getting him and Henderson onto the field, so pushing Henderson out to the back row?
I don't think so. I think Henderson in the back row, you know, it was 2 or 3 years ago that he was playing six. You know, he's playing six for Ulster week in, week out, and then when he was playing for Ireland, he was in the second row, and all his best games came in the second row. I think that's where he suited best. Now he's an absolute beast when it comes to scrum time as well, defending balls. We all know he's got a good work rate and he can carry the ball well, but he doesn't carry in terms of like Jack Conan, where he uses footwork and accelerates onto the ball. He's very collects the ball, stops, goes for a big fend, then uses a bit of footwork. And at the top level, when you're coming up against the South Africans that are going to want to chop you in two, you know, you need more dynamic ball carriers. So I think Henderson in the second row with Ryan. I know we all said that our lineup might fall apart slightly if Devin Toner's not there, but hopefully they can get that sorted and get everybody comfortable with the calls over the next couple of months before they hit Japan. But yeah, I would definitely have the two bigger, more physical guys in the second row, because I think we're slightly lacking a bit of that in the back row.
Yeah, the man who seems to me to have, you know, a lot of this is about timing too. Like, we just see guys go through a purple patch, and it's happening in front of your eyes. And one of the guys who's having that at the moment for me is Conan. I don't know, can he be used across the back row?
Possibly.
Is he pure 8?
I think he is pure 8, yeah. I think his control at the base of the scrum is fantastic. A couple of times against Saracen, when Saracens were in Leinster, Leinster's backs were against the wall, he picked up a couple of times and made some great yards. I think he's been so used to that position to just swap people around to try and see. The other person we haven't mentioned is Tagburn. You know, can Tagburn slip into the back row there, play six? We witnessed him in Scarlets do a tremendous job and, you know, was player of the season over there, playing probably 75% of his rugby in the back row. So can he do a job at six? But then you go, right, okay, we'll have to take a leader out of the pack, and somebody like Peter Omani usually turns up for the big games. So it's all about a balance in that. And I think the balance of this back row going forward, it has to have Josh van der Fleer at seven, and then you need two big guys who are going to carry and are going to muscle up week in, minute in, minute out in these big test matches. So that's the decision Joe has to make. Thankfully, I don't have to make that one, Dara.
I know, but it'd be good fun to be on the sidelines. And just talking about Joe's decisions there, I'm just looking at Ireland-Scotland, Sunday 22nd of September, 8:45 a.m. Live with us here on RTE. You'll probably be in studio with me, Fez. I hope you are. But anyway, then there's the two, Japan-Ireland, Ireland-Russia. I know, not treating them with any disrespect. And then it's Samoa, which will obviously be a bigger physical test. It's, in a way, it's good to have the pool decider up front, isn't it? I mean, because it kind of, our problem before has been playing 2-3 big games in 2-3 weeks. This way, there's a break of the guts of 3 weeks between that pool decider, and maybe that's us being cocky, and a quarterfinal.
I think we would really need to do something wrong not to qualify for a quarterfinal. We all know
you know, who we get on that quarterfinal really depends on that first game against Scotland. So if there's one team in our group stage that I think we can overpower, it is Scotland. Yes, when they have every single man fit, they're a match for anybody. But when they're missing a few people, they seem to drop off. But, you know, I think you're right. I think Ireland getting them up first can really lay down a marker and build momentum. And, you know, come Six Nations time, come Autumn Internationals, come World Cups, it's all about momentum. And you look what happened to Ireland last year in the Six Nations after hiding at the hands of England at the Aviva Stadium. They sort of didn't pick themselves back up after that. So, yeah, I think the Scotland game is going to be huge. It's going to be a big physical battle, and hopefully Ireland can get the job done. And you know, the next games after that, there can be changes and rest guys to make sure everybody's fit and firing for the quarterfinal. But you know, I think when it comes to World Cup, Dan and the lads, I think when it comes to any of the games, they're all going to be tests. You know, I don't think it's just going to be complete walkover 70-80-0. I think, you know, Japan, Samoa, these guys are going to be throwing their weight around, and it's not going to be an easy day at the office.
Well, if something happened against Scotland, I'd agree with you, but I think if we can beat Scotland that first game, it just will course through us, and that'll carry us through the pool stages unbeaten then.
Yeah, but he mightn't risk making 15 changes when you're playing the host country second up, and they're, you know, you're in tough weather conditions, they're throwing the ball around all over the place. You know, and then you're kind of going, well, even if you are resting people, you can't really sleepwalk into a quarter final without being right at the pitch. So,
but do you go along with the one problem? And I know power is just a word, and it covers an awful lot of technical stuff. Is power? And I mean, we're not going to get a power problem against Scotland or Japan.
I've always thought it for years that, like, we're just, barred the likes of this lad on the phone and one or two others, were kind of not the best in terms of that explosive power that probably most manifests in carrying. But I mean, you can do things a little differently too. Now, I mean, Joe's answer in the past to a hiccup has been to do what you're already doing better rather than radically change things. So I wouldn't expect any radical change. But I mean, when Fez started calling them out, there is guys with that explosive power in the team that maybe you forget about. But I mean, for example, I know there's other problems that comes with them, like, you know, is the line-out secure, etc. But, you know, Henderson is one guy. Sean Cronin is a guy who can carry in a different way that means the breakdown collisions don't have to be as attritional.
Develop that for me because I know it's right. I don't know why.
If instead of, like, it seems with Ireland sometimes they're carrying to recycle rather than carry to make line breaks, which, you know, you have to do to a point. But if you're already starting from a physically disadvantaged position and you're willfully asking guys to continuously take ball into contact, knowing full well they're going to be battered out of it, like, that's so demanding mentally, physically. And it's a testament to our players how committed they are and the resilience they have that they did it successfully for a while.
But if
you have a guy who can take that ball from depth, run different angles, beat a guy with footwork, you know, once in a while rather than another truck up, I mean, it's just a huge boost of energy to the team, and it's a bunch of less collisions you have to go into. So
we're going to try
guys like Cronin, Henderson. Like, to me, CJ Stander, I don't know, I'd love to hear what Stephen thinks now. He's not the biggest number eight in the world by any means, but if you look at the type of carrying he's doing now compared to 2 years ago, I think he's almost been a bit naive in terms of being almost too brave for his own good in terms of putting his hand up like cannon fodder, taking ball static with two defenders waiting for him. Look at the line breaks he was making from Munster 2-3 years ago.
But is that static kind of problem part of the overall problem, that the power isn't there to deliver the split second of time and the cleanliness of ball that can allow you to change the angle on that carry?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be great to have like a David Wallace in there, someone like that, you know, that has that explosiveness to break tackles, but
that's just genetic lottery stuff.
I think it's the energy you bring to things and what you're looking to do as well. And Ireland are looking oftentimes to wear teams down through being relentless.
Fez?
Yeah, I think if you're not Ireland, you're another team, and you're analysing Ireland and CJ Stander is playing, or you're Saracens and you're analysing Munster, you know, one of the players that you would target is CJ Stander. You know, you would try and shut him out of the game. Okay, where do Munster get to go forward from? Where did Ireland get to go forward from off slow ball? CJ Stander. So but you would put as much pressure on him as possible. So maybe 2-3 years ago, he wasn't being put under the same amount of pressure, where now teams are going, okay, if we can shut this guy down, keep him quiet, you know, he's only going to make a yard or two here and there. You know, what is it? Some of the stats that have been thrown out over the years, like 25 carries for 15 yards, you know, and stuff like that. So for me, again, Peter Omani, CJ Stander, when was the last time you've seen them sidestep somebody, bump somebody, get an offload, or, you know, get a half line break? Like, I don't think I've ever seen Pete, you know, do that. So I think, you know, I know you talked about David Wallace, but, you know, somebody like Sean O'Brien is David Wallace. You know, he's exactly very, very similar, very explosive, very powerful, maybe not as fast, but, you know, on his game, you know, Sean O'Brien is just an absolute beast of an athlete. And
who's,
you know,
the best one you played with in Ireland during your time, Steve?
Athlete?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think David Wallace, by a long stretch, actually. You know, me and him used to have competitions in the car park pulling sleds before the 2011 World Cup, and we had, you know, laser gates from, say, maybe 20 yards apart, the laser gates, which would measure your time, and would maybe have 50 kgs on the sled, and we had to pull the sled as fast as we could between the gates. Now, that is just all explosive power.
He was 35 at that stage. You were getting off lightly racing
exactly,
then.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was doing it with his teeth.
Like 0.01 second or whatever, and I just couldn't beat him, you know. He was just an absolute beast. He was very, very quick. He probably would admit it himself. He wouldn't have been the most skillful of guys, but he didn't need that. He was a nightmare to try and tackle as well with his leg drive. So, yeah, so somebody like David Wallace or Sean O'Brien would definitely fit into this World Cup 15 of Joe Smith's. But unfortunately, lads, that's not going to be the case.
It's not going to be the case. But one man who is getting a little bit of a reprieve from being, you know, unfairly excoriated throughout is Mike Halley Haley. And what's the story with that? I know Will Addison is on the easy list and probably will come back, injuries notwithstanding, into Joe's training camp. But we don't associate Joe with soft decisions in any way. Is there any sense, and this is only me kind of being an amateur shrink as usual, Stephen, but that he's seen what's happened to the guy? He's played two big games and got very badly mauled by the press and by social media, and he's given him a little bit of a boost for the longer term benefit.
Yeah, I think so. Bruce, why did Haley come over here? Was to try and play international rugby, and Joe's brought him into the squad. I think he had a bit of a nightmare against Saracens and ended up getting substituted early enough in that game. There's no doubt he's a quality player. He's got lots of potential. I think Will Addison's a different kettle of fish altogether. I think he's superb. Will, he plays at 13 or 15.
Exactly.
I think he's just unbelievable. But reports coming from Ulster physio room, really, is that he's, you know, on his way back from back surgery, which, you know, we all know could put you out for a significant period of time. So I think when the squad was lifted, you know, it was funny. It was only Sean O'Brien and Dan Levy who weren't selected due to injury. You know, Will Addison's name wasn't on
there.
Yeah,
we were talking about that. So, yeah.
An interesting one. Maybe Joe's picked up the phone to him and said, look, Will, you know, your priority here is to get yourself fit and try and get into next year's Six Nations squad. You know, that might be his goal. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait and see.
Mm-hmm. I was just looking for the kind of the human angle there. Was there any kind of indication that Joe is aware of confidence and aware of fella's self-esteem as a pro ball player, and he's just given him a little boost at the right time for the longer term?
Mike Haley. We all know how Joe likes to get into lads' heads, and maybe this is a time where he has an opportunity to be able to give Haley a bit of confidence. I think throughout the season he's maybe deserving of a chance in the Irish squad. So you can't just judge a player on one or two games, and you know, I think he's been pretty consistent all year. Like, so yeah, I think he possibly deserves his chance. But if Will Addison was fit, I don't think he would be there.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I'm looking forward to that Sunday morning now, and we'll see if Joe has some new power plays or magic bullets for us. I mean, it's incredible, but he's kind of made his own bed now by being the person who just delivers all the time. I mean, this is his last chance to deliver, but you wouldn't put it past Joe to return the Irish team, whoever the personnel are, injuries notwithstanding, into absolute peak condition and put together
a phenomenal string of performances in September.
Yeah, no, I think Joe's been written off numerous times in the past, and he's always come up trumps, and it would be a brilliant, you know, way to exit Irish rugby, and with, you know, even breaking history and getting to a semi-final. And, you know, every Irish fan has the belief, and I think all the players have the belief that they're good enough to go and win a World Cup. But I think now, as a fan and as a pundit, I think I would love just to see Ireland make history and go one step further than what we've done before. I think one more point before we go, Dara, and I know we haven't touched on it, is, you know, we talk about physical power and lads that are able to get us over the gain line. Somebody like Stuart McCluskey, who, you know, is an Ulster man and has been voted into the Pro 14 Team of the Year, has been probably the most consistent player for Ulster all year. And he, you know, he hasn't even got a look in once again. And, you know, probably one of the most physical, powerful players has worn a white shirt for Ulster. Hasn't even got a look in. So, you know, for me personally, I don't know what the other lads think. For me personally, I think, you know, it's a real shame that he hasn't been drafted in. It could have been very easy for Joe to make that a 45-man squad and bring him in. But, you know, once again, he's been left out.
Yeah, well, that I hadn't thought of that. That, like, adding a name really costs nobody anything. I was looking at, like, who he's up against, and it isn't as if we're particularly threadbare in midfield, though, either, is it?
He's probably more likely to contribute than someone like Rory Scannell, you could argue. He gives you a different skill set than Rory Scannell gives you. I suppose maybe he thinks Chris Farrell gives you a lot of that physicality with a bit more subtlety to his game as well, but he's definitely, you'd think, worth a shot. You think Addison is,
excuse me,
with his versatility, is absolutely worth a shot if fit.
That's the versatility thing gets, you know.
Be interesting to see what Joe does with Jean Klein. You know, his form has dipped for sure in the last year or so, but Joe might be thinking, you know, he has improved guys when he's got him into camp, and he might just think, you know, this guy's 6'8 and 19 and a half stone, and we're a bit talking about being short on power and size. Let's see what we have to work with.
If he could rediscover that form, you know, that he had at the beginning of, not the season just gone, but last season, certainly he looked the real deal. Stephen, just letting you go, and thanks again for joining us. Looking forward to seeing you during the summer. Ulster's season, an improvement on last season. Will we leave it at that?
Yeah, absolutely an improvement on last season. I think that quarter final was probably their final against Leinster, and unfortunately caught a little bit short. But, you know, where they were last year, dogging it out against the Ospreys at home to try and get themselves into Europe, and they find themselves getting into playoffs. So, you know, fair play to them, fair play to Dan McFarland and everybody involved. They've come on leaps and bounds and
steadied it up. Yeah.
Just around here, Dara, I think, you know, just they're walking around Belfast, there's so much more positivity. And I think that's the main thing that's come out of this season.
Okay, as long as you don't say, I'm hearing it on the doorsteps, I don't mind. Not after the week we've had watching the news. Good to talk to you, Stephen. We'll catch up over the summer, no doubt. Stephen Ferris joining us there. Now, what Jacob Stockdale was doing a bit of work for Maxol, which has links to the north as well, an Irish-owned oil company that's familiar with all users of the tarmac of this country.
Yeah, they were just talking about it yesterday. That it seems to be a memory from the childhood that they're dotted around the place, but it was a surprise to someone, a surprise to me, that it was an Irish-owned company in the first place.
Even if it is fossil fuels, we're all for Irish-owned companies. Is that what we're saying?
If it keeps you warm, I think, or if it gets you faster from A to B, I think.
Go on.
As far as the principles extend.
So Jacob Stockdale, he's the brand ambassador for Maxol.
Correct. And we caught up with him yesterday. I had a good chat.
Jacob Stockdale, welcome to the RT Rugby Podcast. Let me be the first to congratulate you. The team news, or the squad has been announced, so you're on the training panel.
Okay, that's good news, yeah.
Were you worried at all?
A little bit, yeah, you know, I hadn't heard much from Joe. But no, that's good. It's nice to kind of have that off your mind going into the holidays.
Let's just start with Ulster. Previous season, for different reasons, was a bit of a mess up there. You had a coach who came in late to pre-season. A lot of people from the outside would have been thinking maybe that this is a season for Ulster Rugby to consolidate, to get to learn the coach, to take in a massive amount of new players and learn a new system. You surprised a lot of people from the outside. How surprised was the camp at how far you got during the season?
Look, I don't think there was a massive amount of surprise within the players, you know. There's a lot of guys, you know, that within the group that have said that this is the hardest working Ulster team they've ever been a part of, and I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, going into a season where the season before has been real turbulent and real tough, like, you know, it kind of galvanized us as a group, and obviously that worked to our benefit. Yeah, and look, I think, you know, we're just real proud of the guys, you know, at how hard they worked, and, you know, they got the reward for that to a certain extent. But yeah, look, it was a good building season, and you don't want to rest on your laurels and say, you know, we did more than people expected us to, so that's okay. You know, that's not okay. We want to keep moving forward.
It has enough time passed now from the Glasgow match to assess everything in that bigger picture view and maybe set some new goals for next year that you maybe didn't have at the start of the season.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the Glasgow match was very disappointing for us as a group. You know, we just didn't perform. You know, it was probably one of our worst performances of the season, which is obviously really disappointing to get in a semi-final. And I guess that's just an experience thing, you know, of playing at that level and learning how to win at that level. So it was disappointing for us. But, you know, yeah, looking back at the season as a whole, like, you have to look at it as a positive and say, you know, at least we were there. And then next year it's, okay, we get there for sure this time, but how do we win it?
Now, just the news has also broken that Rob Kearney has signed an extension. You've played a couple of games at fullback during the season. We saw down in Munster where maybe the IRFU had a lot of input into Joey Carberry getting game time at out half. Does that trickle down into positional play at Ulster? Do you know if Joe Smith has said to Dan, I want to see this man at fullback, he needs a couple of outings? Were you in that conversation, or is that purely an Ulster thing?
I honestly have no idea, to be completely honest with you. You know, it was more of a... I came about playing fullback because, you know, they needed me to play fullback, and, you know, we had a lot of injuries, and I really, really enjoy it. But I enjoy playing wing as well, you know, so it's really wherever anybody wants me, I'll play. I don't know if that conversation was had, but they also seem to be interested in me at fullback now anyway.
If I had to give you one jersey, 11 or 15, what would you pick?
To be honest, I'd say I probably would pick 15. I find that I get more enjoyment there. Like, you know, I just get the ball in my hands a bit more, and, you know, I just, you know, feel a bit more comfortable there. But at the same time, you know, it's literally, you know, like 99% or 100%, you know, that's how tight it is between the two of them. And getting to play on the wing is brilliant, and I really, really enjoy that too. So, you know, whichever jersey that they decide to hand me, you know, I'll be happy to play either.
I know we were talking about your 2018, and a lot of people told you nothing lasts forever. This doesn't come this easy. Within the Ireland camp, when we talk about 2018, Johnny Sexton is very keen to remind us that there were small margins in those games. So there was a drop goal in Paris. There was an intercept at the end of the Wales match. A lot of these games turned on small points. So within the Ireland camp, when we look at the England match and the Wales match, there wasn't a small margin. The games were kind of out of reach long before the final whistle. Did that come as a surprise from when we were talking about the small margins, that it was actually quite a considerable gap?
Yeah, like, you know, I think to a certain extent, but, you know, like, okay, like, yeah, Johnny, you know, talks about small margins, but there was also, you know, a couple other games there where there weren't small margins, you know, and we beat teams really well, you know, like the England game, like, we beat England very well in Twickenham, you know. I mean, the Italy game, we put 50 points on them. The Scotland game, you know, we were well ahead in that game as well. And, you know, if you look at Wales's Grand Slam win, you know, away to France, it was a last-minute intercept that won them that game. And, you know, again, England, it was very tight margins, you know. So there's not always going to be these tight margins. Like, it's, you know, some games you are going to win outright and win well. But to win a Grand Slam, you have to get those tight margins to go your way. And so, yeah, I don't think it's particularly worrying for us that you know, that in one of Wales's games, they got away from us a bit, you know, and obviously it's disappointing. And, you know, we expect more from ourselves as a team, but I wouldn't say it's worrying, no.
The way we won in 2018 seemed to be a very prescriptive play. It worked absolutely brilliant. It was executed very well. And the turnaround to 2019 was where teams had kind of had time to read what Ireland were doing and come up with a counterbalance. There's a lot of talk about Ireland going back to what they know best, the success of 2018, but does something else have to be thought of now if teams have figured out Ireland in a certain way?
No, I don't think so. You know, like, that's why Joe's such a brilliant coach, is that, you know, he looks at teams and, you know, there's nobody in the world that will study a team more than Joe will, like, inside out, and he comes up with a plan, you know, of attack that suits that team. And, you know, I don't think there's massive amount of change that needs to happen. I think there was differences between us in 2018 and 2019, but it was more down to, you know, inaccuracy in our attack, you know, maybe not having quite as much energy in defence, and, you know, in our kick chase, and, you know, there's just wee things that were maybe just missing in 2019 than there was in 2018. And those are the kind of things that, you know, you want to fix going into a World Cup.
Just coming into the World Cup, there's four friendly fixtures. They're kind of funny. What's it like for a player going into a match? You'll be playing England in Twickenham. It won't have the intensity. We'll say, England and Twickenham is always a big game, but it's not a Six Nations game. It's not a World Cup game. What's it like for players, or what do you think it'll be like going in to play four friendly matches? Is there a little bit of worry about getting an injury, or is it, I have to put my hand up for a place in the side?
Yeah, I think, like, you know, obviously, yeah, there is that worry of injury, you know, going into a World Cup warm-up game, when realistically, you know, you are looking ahead to that World Cup and you're going, I want to make sure I'm there. But, like, at the same time, you know, it's your last opportunity to make sure you're playing your best rugby going into a World Cup. And, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be kind of trotting around at 50%. You know, everybody's going to be giving it, you know, everything they have. And I'm, you know, I've no doubt that the coaches and the SNCA medical staff will make sure that they look after us enough that we can go out and you know, put in 100% performance in those warm-up games.
You're on a little bit of a break now. I saw on Instagram you were on the beach with the family and the dogs. Yeah. Is there a lot of that in your downtime? I know you obviously are like rugby and watching it, but when you're on your break now, will it be more family time, relaxing?
Yeah, it definitely will be. You know, getting away tomorrow, and yeah, I'm just really excited about getting onto a beach, getting a beer in my hand and not thinking about rugby for a while, you know. And like, I think that's really important in terms of, you know, freshening yourself up going into, you know, such a long slog, you know, because, I mean, from the 16th of June, I'm going to be flat out until the 2nd of November, which is, you know, quite a long time to be focusing on rugby and to be, you know, really working hard. So, yeah, I think it's important to get the relaxation and the enjoyment, you know, in the next couple of weeks.
I know Rory is a big Tottenham fan, or his young lad is a big Tottenham fan. Will you get to see the match? Have you any allegiance?
No, I don't really have any allegiance. I'd quite like Liverpool to win just so that Bessie's annoyed. Like, but in fairness, no, I watched both the semi-finals and it was great to see, you know, class football to watch and all that. So, yeah, I've no really allegiance to either team, so I'm just hoping it'll be entertaining.
You'll watch it anyway?
Oh, yeah, I'll watch it, definitely, yeah. Maybe we Istanbul 2005. Hopefully it's as interesting as that. Like, but
very good. I know when the modern rugby players are surrounded by a lot of advisors and PR people, but on your social media you've been quite active, and it's a virtue in this day and age that you haven't been told to hush, or you've decided to ignore that. Yeah. If you have, and I know that your faith is very important to you, and that in itself is a virtue. When you saw what happened with the Israel Folau thing and the Billy Vinapola and the different angles that were coming out, what was your whole take on that? Was it more to do with this a man who is almost preaching in his position what he believes in, and that's fine, and that it was blown up, or that he has a responsibility because of his position not to come up with stuff like that?
I think, like, it's a really really difficult you know, matter to address. You know, on one hand you want to say, you know, like, Israel Folau has, you know, is entitled to his religious beliefs, he's entitled to freedom of speech, so why shouldn't he be able to make a post like that? On the other hand, you know, he's a professional rugby player, you know, there's a lot of people who are supporters of him, and he is a representative of not just himself, but also Australian rugby and the Waratahs, and, you know, you have a certain, you know, kind of responsibility to not offend people and to not, you know, alienate people in that sense, I suppose. For me personally, I felt the way in which he went around, you know, the post was insensitive, and I felt like he could have, you know, he could have done it in a much, much better manner, where, you know, he's still respecting other people, but also he's using his right to express his religious belief and express his freedom of speech. You know, when you look at the Billy Vinapola thing, I think he maybe did it in a slightly more respectful way, and I thought the backlash against him was quite harsh, but at the same time, I can understand why people were annoyed about that. Whenever, you know, he did come out in support of Israel Folau's tweet, which was, you know, kind of, which I did think was quite offensive.
How does your faith help you in your rugby career and in your personal life?
I think, look, just it helps me, you know, in my rugby, just because, you know, it's an opportunity to just kind of, you know, whenever things aren't going your way, to just hand it over and go, look, this isn't my problem anymore, this is your problem, God. And that's obviously a massive part of me, and I believe that he is out with me on the pitch, you know, which is really, really cool. You know, my personal life, like, it is a challenge, and don't get me wrong, I'm not the perfect person. I get it wrong an awful lot. You know, sometimes I say there's a lot of people that look at me and go, is that lad even really a Christian? And that's the kind of, you know, struggle that I have to fight every day. But you know, I wouldn't change my religious beliefs for the world, and you know, there's a reason that I keep them.
Just finish off on the World Cup, looking forward to it. For people of my generation and not your generation, there's a lot of baggage associated with Ireland and World Cups. Will it help you that you say you can remember back to 2011, which was, there's a lot of good memories from that World Cup. 2015, there was a couple of good matches in that, but ultimately it seemed to weigh down, the quarterfinal seemed to, the pressure seemed to weigh down. Is it good that you don't have the historical baggage when Ireland go to try and get to a first semi-final?
I don't really know, to be honest with you. Obviously there's massive kind of positives of having played in a World Cup before, where you've got that experience and you know what to expect. But yeah, like you say, there is also the advantage of not having played in a World Cup, where you're going in with absolutely no fear of what's happened before. So yeah, I suppose there's kind of two sides to it in that sense.
When Ireland drew Scotland in the pool stages a couple of years ago, Jamie Heaslip was injured, but he was still part of the squad. There was a reporter there at the time. He was doing an event, and he seemed to punch the air and expressed that there wasn't that there was worse groups. If that had happened the other way around, and a Scotland guy expressed delight at getting Ireland, how would you think that would go down in the Ireland camp?
Probably not particularly well, I'd imagine. Yeah, no, like, it's, you know, I think especially in a World Cup, you have to respect every single team that you play in. And, you know, yeah, fair enough, you might not have the big Englands or the Australias or the South Africas or New Zealands, but, you know, in the last World Cup, you know, say that our Scotland pushed Australia to the point where they probably should have beaten them if it hadn't been for a dodgy decision. And, you know, you look at that and you go,
Japan beat South Africa.
Exactly. You know, and I think a World Cup is a separate entity, and it's so different to any other rugby you're going to play, and you have to respect every single team massively in that sense.
Can you win the World Cup?
I think so, yeah, definitely.
What will it come down to?
That's the...
When you look at how it breaks down, so if things go according to form, New Zealand or South Africa in a quarter-final, but then there's a very short turnaround to a semi-final and a final. Yeah. Do you think Ireland has the strength and depth? It'll be three massively physical games, yeah, in a short space of time, just over 2 weeks. Are we better prepared now?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, you look at the depth that we've had over the last, you know, couple of Six Nations. You know, if you even take the teams from the last three Six Nations, they've changed massively, you know, and that's great to have. You know, like, you look at our centres, you take away, you know, Robbie, Gary, Bundy, you know, you still got Chris Farrell, like Stuart McCloskey, Rory Scannell, Tom Farrell, like those guys there, like, you know, could start on any other international team, and that's the kind of depth that we have and that we have to have going into a World Cup. So yeah, look, it's really exciting, and I think we're in a really good place to do well in it.
Thanks very much for coming on the RT Rugby Podcast, and best of luck.
No worries, cheers, man.
Jacob Stockdale, chatting to you, Michael.
Yeah, no, he was in good form yesterday. And he had a lot of work on. Obviously, when those media days come out, you're working all day. But he's in good form. Looking forward to his break and then the World Cup.
Other stuff?
Yeah, the Ireland under-20s are underway over to Argentina for the World Championship. And they're obviously Grand Slam champions. They will play Australia, Italy and England over in Argentina. And between June 7th and 9th, Dublin hosts the Union Cup, which is Europe's biggest LGBT and inclusive rugby tournament. That's out in DCU.
Grand. Okay, well, thanks for that. And Wes, thanks. Enjoy the summer. I know you're working on the Sunday game, so it's
a very switch. Very controversial, not giving more of a doff of the hat to Leinster after winning their umpteenth trophy in the last decade, the weekend.
I'm all World Cup all the time now.
Okay, fair enough. Don't say I didn't warn you.
I did say that they deserved it. They did, of course. I mean, they were magnificent during the season. But I have to say that it's just forgotten about very quickly if you're not a Leinster supporter. I just want to look forward to the World Cup now.
Yeah, some good news.
We'll be back for the World Cup warm-up games. Thanks for listening during the season. Hope you enjoyed some of our weapons-grade waffling. But we will be back in August with you. Thanks to Michael and Wes here in studio, Stephen Ferris on the phone, Jacob Stockdale, and thanks to John Farrell and Patrick Carney here behind the glass. We'll see you in August. Have a great June and July. Go easy.